everyone in podcast land. Welcome back to the Front Row Podcast, the podcast for people who actually like movies. And I'm telling you, if you're not sick of all the Oscars coverage yet, I mean, we got two more that we can try and break your will here, because we are still deep diving with our Oscars spotlights. We are breaking down, well, we already did break down all the movies, the big movies nominated, but now we are almost done with our category spotlights, and we're going to give you best actor here today. I'm Jeremy Gechner, the editor-in-chief, and here with me, as always, the film historian of the Front Row, Mr. Brandon Davis. What's up, man?
Well, hello. We started, and now we're finishing.
That's right. That's right. We got one more left after this, which is the huge discussion we did on Best Picture. That will be coming out tomorrow, which is, of course, Oscar Sunday. And so that's going to be the last one that you guys get to hear. Interesting stuff. It's going to be a closer race than I think people might be giving credit for right now. But that is for another time and place. We are here to talk about Best Actor. But before we do that, though, Brandon and I know that just yesterday we lost a film icon, one of the truly legendary actors of all time, in Mr. Kirk Douglas. Yeah. And I know that you wanted to say just a little piece about that, as we're about to talk about leading actors. Man, this was one of those legendary leading actors of all time.
Yeah, he's one of the he's one of those few, though, that did not win a competitive Oscar over his career. He was, you know, in the category of people like Cary Grant and Barbara Stanwyck and people like that, who ended up getting an honorary Oscar, saying, you know, hey, sorry, we never got around to you or whatever. But, you know, it's, I mean, first of all, to have lived to the age of 103, and he had, a debilitating stroke over 20 years ago. And, you know, lived through that. He was a tough guy and a good man all around, from what you hear. I read the wonderful things like his son Michael has said about him, and his daughter-in-law, Catherine Zeta-Jones, and about what a presence he was in their lives. And, it's just interesting to read all the stories about how he was really the first major celebrity to buck the blacklist and gave Dalton Trumbo a job as one of the screenwriters on Spartacus. So, he was usually on the right side of history, and, he was just a, really strong guy. And of course, you know, his work speaks for itself. And, I'm planning on, once we're done with all the Oscar craziness, writing an article for our website talking about his five greatest screen roles. I think I can narrow it down.
But, that's a tall task.
I was just, it's funny, over New Year's, I was just watching his performance in The Bad and the Beautiful, where he plays Jonathan Shields, this maniacal studio executive. And he's just fantastic. And he has this ferocity, but he also could play very sensitive stuff. I'm thinking about like his performance as Van Gogh in Lust for Life.
And
he could play Doc Holliday in Gunfight at the OK Corral. And of course, Spartacus, and then movies like Paths of Glory. I mean, just all over the place, and worked right up until he couldn't. So yeah, just one of the last great stars of that golden age. We're losing too many, and we're getting to where we won't have any at all. But a big loss. But yeah, the great thing about movies is they live forever. So yeah, you can go back and watch it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't have much to add to that. You're right, though. Like, if you haven't seen his performance as Van Gogh, that is one of the I don't want to say lost, you know, but it's just, it's one that I feel like is never really brought to the forefront, not just of his career, but in movie history. And it is wonderful work that he's doing there. Mm-hmm. Of course, everybody thinks of Spartacus, and rightfully so. It's a tour de force performance in movie history. But I also agree with you that what I think of is not like the Dalton Trumbo stuff after, you know, and honestly, I didn't think of it until I saw the movie with Bryan Cranston and, you know, started doing my research. And yeah, he was very much his own thinker in Hollywood at a time when that was a pretty dangerous thing to be. And the fact that he, you know, did go out there and buck that blacklist is probably one of those more enduring things that you can see, especially considering the arc of history. So yeah, 103, long, yeah. amazing life. That was Sarah when I told her, I showed her the story, and she goes literally like, oh, but I mean, he was a million. So and it did seem like he was just going to live to a million, but we're going to miss you, Kirk. So there you go, everyone. But let's bring it into the present here, and let's talk about best actor race this year. So we're going to get to the main five here that are nominated. But before that, Brandon, I know that this was one of those podcasts that everybody on the network wanted to be on at one point or another, because there's so many great male lead performances this year. And obviously the Oscar only has five spots. So do you have any that you think literally had a good claim to be here, or that other people have told us to say had a good claim to be here?
The one that comes to mind, if I were personally an Oscar voter, and Aaron McKay will love me for saying this, but Taron Egerton and Rocket Man.
Absolutely.
I saw Rocket Man back in the summer, and his performance completely wowed me. And I've said this on the podcast before, nothing against Rami Malek. I think he was fine in Bohemian Rhapsody, but I think Taron Egerton's performance in Rocket Man just takes it a level above. He wasn't doing, an impression, whatever. I think he really inhabited Elton John's spirit, and he's very funny in it, and he has this sardonic wit, but he also really shows you what the pain of addiction is, and he really goes dark, and he really goes deep in that movie, and it's really, really great to watch.
Yeah, for a movie that's as like kind of glitzy as that, it's also very raw. Yeah. That movie is. They don't shy away from any of the really, really, scandalous parts of his life. No. And Elton even told them while making it, it's my life. Yeah. This is what happened. That movie, all of Taron Egerton's movie starness is on display in that movie. Not just his incredible acting ability, but his undeniable charm, and of course his fantastic singing voice. I think that, I've been a fan of his ever since the first Kingsman, and I think we've got a superstar on our hands here with Taron Egerton. So I would put him there too. I did say that I would give Lou Hare's choices out here, and I do see the part here. Adam Sandler, obviously a lot of people see him as a snub in this category for Uncut Gems. As I understand it, that movie is pretty divisive. You either kind of really love it, or you're kind of exhausted by it in 10 minutes and you can't quite appreciate it. But Sandler, by all rights, has gotten fantastic reviews for this movie, and he's once again reminding us that he's capable of great things if he puts his mind to it, it seems, or maybe if he gets the opportunities. Maybe I'm being too harsh on him there, but he did make the claim though that he was going to make the worst movie ever made if he didn't get nominated. So looking forward to that one, 2020 or beyond. And of course, Lou also thinks that Eddie Murphy for Dolomite Is My Name had a pretty good claim to this one. What do you think of those two picks from Lou?
Yeah, I think Lou sent out to our Facebook group that we have an article that has like secret feelings that several Academy voters have. And, it's just obvious that certain members of the Academy, despite how good of a performance it is, if you're a certain type of actor or performer, you're not necessarily going to be included into the elite group, so to speak. But but I think I if there was one that I think would have gotten in over the other, I can see Eddie Murphy sliding in over Sandler, because we've seen Eddie Murphy nominated before for Dreamgirls. But I don't think Adam Sandler necessarily endears himself when he says things like he's going to make the worst movie ever.
Yeah. I did love it that Jennifer Aniston called him out in her SAG acceptance speech. Did. I thought that was pretty fun. but it's true. It's like, it's not the first time we've seen really good, like award worthy, Sandler, Punch Drunk Love. Think of some of his stuff with James Brooks and James L. Brooks in the mid, 2000s there. He's got a lot of talent. He's a very talented performer, but either by choice or by studio decree, he's always put in the kind of really let's just say bad comedies that he does now. And, you know, it's good though to see though Eddie Murphy and Adam Sandler though continue to branch out though, because Murphy's another one that's got wonderfully good dramatic chops, even as funny as he is. And Dolomite is one of those feel good movies of the year, as Phil said there. But just a ton of really, really great performance. I mean, you remember at the Golden Globes, they of course split their lead actor categories, and you know, I was looking at those when they came out, and I was like, I don't know how they're going to get this down to five. And they didn't. And of course, I mean, like, look, one of the best performances of the year, many see Christian Bale not here in this for Ford v. Ferrari. He was getting nominated in every critic circle and yet shut out of this one. So it's just, it's a very, very tough year for people to break into.
Yeah. My only other snub that I can really think of, because really, when I look at this list of five, I don't think there's anybody I could honestly say I would take off the list.
Right.
But, you know, if we were able to expand it, like the Best Picture Award or whatever, to other nominees, I would have put Roman Griffin Davis from Jojo Rabbit in there. It is a It is a solid child performance. You know, I think it might be the best, like, child performances, maybe like Haley Joel Osment in The Sixth Sense or something like that. Cause he delves deep into more than what you think like a 12-year-old kid can do. And he's dealing with really mature issues, and he's a kid playing satire, which is hard for a kid to grasp.
playing Taika Waititi satire, that is even harder.
Yeah, and he's funny and he's heartbreaking and everything. So it would have been cool to see him included. But once again, like it's hard to argue with these five that are listed, but there are certainly ones that you could have included as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And another one I heard from the 1917 podcast, George MacKay for 1917.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, that movie is such an ensemble piece, and kind of like the set and, you know, like the way it's shot is kind of a character in the movie as well. But yeah, he really carries most of that action, and the most thrilling sequence in that film, I think the nighttime sequence that I don't want to give away too much, but the, you know, running through the city at night, he has a physicality and a look on his face that just tells a lot of stories without needing any lines. So
absolutely.
I think that George MacKay might have a pretty decent future in front of him too. But
yeah.
Well, that's enough of the people who didn't get nominated. Come on, what are we doing here? What are we doing? Regrets? Let's get to the people who are here. So we're just going to go through alphabetical order here, how the Academy lists them, and just talk about some of these performances. And we're going to tell you why we think they deserve to win the Best Actor Oscar, and then we'll make our actual picks at the end. So, Brandon, let's start out here with Antonio Banderas for Pedro Almodóvar's Pain and Glory. This is, of course, a foreign language film and kind of an autobiographical film about Almodóvar's love of cinema and how he kind of came back to it. And by all rights, most of the critics are saying this is Antonio Banderas's best performance of his career. It is his first Academy Award nomination, which kind of is crazy when you think about it, because he's been around for so long and he's been right there at the forefront in Hollywood for so long. What do you think of this performance? What do you think of this nomination for Antonio Banderas?
It's a solid performance. I mean, I have to say, I'm not an expert on Antonio Banderas's career. I don't know that I've seen the whole realm of what his body of work is to really tell you, but he's wonderful in this. And I think we've slept on him for way too long. I think he's, you know, he's delivered solid work in various different types of movies, but there's something about this performance of Pain and Glory that really, you can tell, cuts to his heart. And I think, you know, it has to do with, you know, love of movies, love of, you know, his home. And, you know, he just delivers a passion in this that you really haven't gotten from him for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's such a, you know, you're right in the saying that it's almost a very quiet performance too. I mean, like he doesn't need a lot of big flashy monologues or a lot of like giant emotive scenes to make such an impact in this movie. And you know, actually Antonio and Pedro Almodóvar have worked together for so many years. Almodóvar actually gave him his big break down in Mexico, I believe. And, you know, and then from there on, and now he's kind of sort of playing him in a movie that, you know, Almodóvar is directing as well. Yeah. So there's just a lot of emotions here. And yeah, it is just, it's one of those performances where you then look back at Antonio's career and you think like, yeah, man, like why, you know, like why haven't we been thinking of him as one of those, you know, big dramatic actors that can do parts like this and wrench our hearts like that. So, you know, and honestly, you know, a reason why it could win is the obvious reason of just like, you know, you might want to reward that kind of a thing. You know, you nominate him and then you're like, oh yeah, man, we maybe have been taking this guy for granted. And that sentimentality can sometimes lead to some Oscar votes. So but I think it's very, very worthy performance though. I'm right there with you. Yeah, anything else on Antonio Banderas there?
I don't think so. I do think if there's a possibility for an Olivia Colman to happen, yeah, he could be one. He could be the one to do it, maybe.
He would be – he and the other one a little later, Jonathan Pryce, I think, could be the, you know, oh, right, those guys, you know, award them ones. But let's keep it moving here. Leonardo DiCaprio for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Man, I – there is just so much you could say about this performance. You know, again, this sounds weird to say. It really does because it's Leonardo DiCaprio. But, you know, after winning the Oscar for The Revenant, have we kind of, again, kind of done this whole, you know, okay, here's your Oscar, now keep doing your thing with him? And I don't know if we fully appreciate how good he is in every single movie, because this is not your typical Leo. Like, Rick Dalton is a very – there's a lot of complex emotions he's dealing with in this. And the fact that he does them all so seamlessly, I mean, I am blown away by this performance. I really am.
Yeah. This is I think I've said this before. I think after having – I saw this – fall when it came out, but then seeing it again, I think this is my favorite movie of the year. I love it. I love it. And I'm usually not a huge Tarantino guy, but I just, there's something different about this movie. And Leo's great. Leo is great. I think about the scene after he does that, he finally does that great piece of work with that little girl. And when she tells him that's the greatest acting she's ever seen, and just the emotion that comes across him, it is so good. And you're right. It's not typical Leo. It's not, you know, it's not The Revenant, you know, which, you know, I would have given him an Oscar for performances way before that. But,
Aviator, but, anyone? Come on.
Yeah, Catch Me If You Can. But yeah, he is a movie star, and he's playing a movie star, and it totally fits. But he plays the wide range of emotions. He goes from the incredibly touching to the incredibly ridiculous, all within the same realm of the movie.
You believe it. Yeah, and you're right, because it's like this era of Hollywood is so, like, the acting is always, like, so over the top and so over dramatic most of the time. And, you know, all those little clips we get to see of, like, the shows and the guest spots he does, and they're all, like, kind of ridiculous. But at the same time, there's just such this tenderness and this, like, desire to still be not just relevant, but still make great art. You know, you feel like Rick Dalton really does care about making great art through acting. Yeah. And, you know, the fact that that's also kind of mixed in with, like, his own self-consciousness. I mean, I think one of the best film scenes of the year is him freaking out in the trailer after messing up his lines in the rehearsal. Mm-hmm. I think that's just like, you're just watching a master work for this little short amount of time. And, you know, I also love that he's not like the big brash hero at the end of the movie, that he's kind of like the, you know, like he's just sitting in there in the pool and everything, and he's kind of aloof to what's going on. It's just kind of a different look for him.
Yeah, it's great. Brad Pitt's done all the heavy lifting, and then he comes in and just puts the punctuation mark at the end.
Yeah, exactly. And if anybody hasn't seen it, that is all we're going to say, because that, man, the last 10 minutes of this movie are bonkers, by Tarantino standards. But all right, well, let's keep it rolling here, and let's go to Adam Driver for Marriage Story, playing Charlie. You know, it's been seen as kind of a two-horse race this whole season. Obviously, Joaquin Phoenix has gotten most of the gold, but man, I have a hard time finding a better performance this year than Adam Driver's in Marriage Story. Brandon, let's get your thoughts on that one first. What do you think of Adam Driver here?
Yeah, I think he gives us one of the most complex character portrayals.
There you go.
Because, and Craig has said this many times, you know, where you're on Charlie's side most of the movie until you get like toward the end and you're like, man, he's pretty emotionally abusive, this guy.
Yeah.
And, but you still, he has his faults, but you still like him. You still, it's the same way with Scarlett's character. You take sides constantly between the two of them throughout all of Marriage Story. And, it's rare. I mean, and of course it's a credit to the writing too, but it's a three-dimensional human being that Driver is creating. So if you were to watch like this and Rise of Skywalker back to back, and you see like, I mean, but really it gives you what, you know, the breadth of what Driver can do. And he's quick. I mean, he's quickly becoming one of my favorites just because there is something so unique and human about him. And he really delves deep, and yeah, man, it's a tough one, but yeah, I think this has got to be definitely the most complete performance we've gotten out of anybody all year.
Yeah, his task in Marriage Story, I feel, is harder even than Scarlett Johansson's, because all of the bad stuff that happens to Nicole is stuff that's in the past that we don't flash back to, you know? So we only get to hear about that stuff. All of the stuff that really drives him nuts and is tragic about him, we get to see firsthand. So naturally we want to, you know, sympathize with him because we're actually seeing it happen in real time. Mm-hmm. But you're right. The whole portrait of Charlie in this is a guy who loves to control things. And it is so slowly that you understand what Nicole has gone through being married to this man. And it's not that he's not evil or anything. There's no like ultimate evil act. I mean, I guess there's one if you wanted to, but you know, it's kind of never dealt with in that way in this movie. Right. It's always kind of a side note, but you know, you start to get the sense that, yeah, like you understand how she could be so unhappy in a marriage that seemingly would, you know, have everything that you would want out of it. And the slow unraveling, because literally throughout this whole movie, he keeps losing control little by little of the things that he thinks he should have control over. And it just culminates in that living room fight scene. And it is just, and he just gets to explode. And you just get to see the full breadth in those 5 to 10 minutes of what Adam Driver is.
The scene that's also going to stay with me is the scene where he cuts himself and he lays on the floor.
Oh, man.
And, you know, just without saying anything, you know, and you just know the turmoil that he's going through.
Yeah.
And it's all there, you know, that, you know, he can't let his son see this. He can't let this get out, you know, and he's just, he's just making him think the dad's going to lay on the floor for a little bit.
Oh my God. It's like that 3 minute sequence is like more cringy than anything I've ever seen on The Office. And it is just like, oh man, I wanted that scene to end so bad. Yeah. And also, I mean, I'll tell you this, sang pretty good version of Being Alive too. Dude's got some good emotion there. I want to see him on Broadway someday.
He did. And I've said this before. I said, you know, and I can't say enough about Marriage Story. I thought it was just going to be another rehash of Kramer versus Kramer. But, what Kramer versus Kramer did was it really made you, I mean, you knew that Dustin Hoffman was the better parent. It really painted Meryl Streep as the lesser of the two, but this one, it really put them both on the same level. I felt like it really made it a lot more complex and adult. So yeah, absolutely. And bravo to both Driver and Johansson for that.
Yeah, both of them very, very well deserved. I mean, go back and listen to the best actress discussion that I believe you were a part of, Brandon.
Yes.
But yeah, and I think that obviously we just told you many reasons why Adam Driver should win it. And honestly, I think if there's going to be an upset, I think this is the one. I think if somebody's going to unseat Phoenix, it's going to be Adam Driver. And, you know, I won't be upset if that happens. But let's get to that front runner. Let's get to Mr. Joaquin Phoenix playing Arthur Fleck, a.k.a. the Joker in Todd Phillips's Joker. The movie that made $1 billion in the last year, $1 billion hardcore mental health drama that happens to star a comic book villain. What world do we live in, Brandon? look, I was on the Oscar spotlight for Joker. My thoughts about Phoenix's performance are pretty known. So, Brandon, what do you think of Joaquin Phoenix in this movie? And why do you think that he's literally gone 4 for 4 so far in the award circuit?
Well, I mean, it's an incredibly well-crafted movie all around. But I think his performance is the, if you didn't have his performance, you wouldn't have a movie.
Yep.
And he creates a portrait of an incredibly damaged human being who, you know, you don't, and you're not supposed to make excuses for.
Right.
But you do feel sorry for him in certain ways, just because of the hands he's been dealt in life. It doesn't excuse what he does, you know, as the film goes on. But yeah, I mean, talk about someone transforming, you know, we talked last week about Renee Zellweger transforming herself. Talk about someone who really transformed himself, you know, with, you know, the weight loss and, you know, just yeah. really, you know, there are times where I thought, man, it looks like he's near death. But, yeah. You know, Joaquin Phoenix has delivered great performance after great performance while not being the most stable individual in real life, it seems just like. Saying,
yeah.
So, but yeah, I mean, you can't argue with his performance is a work of art, no matter how you, no matter what you think about the movie. And the more and more I think about it, the movie I think is very artfully done. I can't say that I necessarily like it just because, its view of the world is very hard for me to swallow. But
sure.
but yeah, I mean, he Heath Ledger really put his stamp on that role, but I think Joaquin will go down in history as putting his stamp on that role as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, again, it's you cannot, even if you have problems with the movie, mm-hmm. like our columnist Phil Rockwell wrote a insanely good article that called out his problems with the movie. But even in that article, could not say a bad word about Joaquin Phoenix's portrayal because mm-hmm. it's just there. And Jay Hoffman, when we were on the spotlight, said that he read an article about a criminologist that deals with, like, you know, portraits of psychopaths and how they happen, and said when they saw this movie that they were shocked at how correct they got all of this, because it's like the perfect recipe for how, you know, somebody, you know, gets kind of descends into wanting to do violence like this. And you're right, it's a delicate balance between empathy and sympathy in this. You can empathize with what Arthur's going through without sympathizing the decisions that he makes. And, you know, I think in most of the film they do that, and I think there's other aspects where they kind of don't. But at the same time, though, you literally get to see this slow unraveling, and literally every strand of his sanity just keeps getting cut and keeps getting cut. And, you know, until finally there's nothing left. And it's not just a caricature performance. It's not just, you know, like laugh and laugh and laugh. Like, those laughing fits are terrifying in this movie, because you can tell it, like, doing it as a Tourette's-y type thing that he doesn't have control over is, you know, you could see the terror in his eyes that he wants to stop, but he can't. Yeah. And then it just even develops even more into a psychosis by the end.
Yeah. That's one of the things I left the movie saying. I'm like, what a living hell it's got to be to have that disorder. I'm just like, to break out laughing in inappropriate situations has got to be one of the worst things to ever experience. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, it's like those little touches and those kind of accurate portrayals of mental illness that make this not a gimmick performance, you know, in any way. It's not one of those that's like, oh, look, he's playing the Joker. He puts it in more of a real world setting. Oh yeah, of course they're going to vote for him. This is, if this wins best actor, it is insanely earned. It is definitely, I think, one of the easily the top two male lead performances of the year. So, you know, I can go back and forth on Driver and him, but either of those is more than worthy in my mind. All right. Well, that leaves one left. Let's talk about Jonathan Pryce here in the two popes playing current Pope, Pope Francis, not Saint Pope Francis, maybe Saint someday. Who knows? He's got some time to work some miracles, right? So this is obviously the Netflix film that is the true story of the kind of transition of power from Pope Benedict the 16th, I think, maybe 14th, one of those. double check for me, Brandon. Pope Benedict and then to Pope Francis. And Pope Benedict, of course, famously kind of gave up power after the big scandals that were rocking the Catholic Church and gave up power to Pope Francis there. So this is such an odd movie to me, because like you see a movie like The Two Popes that's about a power transition from one pope to another. I was not expecting to laugh as much as I did in this movie, and it's oddly very humorous and very touching in many ways. And I think Jonathan Pryce is the heart of that. I think that he really plays up this man who never really ever expects that he will come anywhere close to being a pope. And yet now he's, you know, talking to the pope and, you know, like, and it's there. And of course, just in real life, it's Jonathan Pryce, who's this wonderful actor who's always been great. You know, he's been Broadway, he's been in movies, he's been on TV and never done anything bad. And now he's getting his first Oscar nomination here. And it's kind of so amazingly well earned. And even if it's just a thanks for coming, like it's really great to see him included in this list.
It's a wonderfully elegant performance from Jonathan Pryce and from Hopkins too. Brian and I talked about on the supporting actor. I kind of argued, and he argued again. I said, you know, it's really, you know, if you think about it, Hopkins is really a lead performance as well. I mean, the movie is called The Two Popes, but he kind of convinced me that really what Hopkins is doing is supporting Pryce, you know, literally, in the movie or whatever. But yeah, I just you just really like this man, and you like what he stands for, and the fact that he never ever thought of himself in that position at all, and found himself, you know, we love to watch these stories about just ordinary people having greatness thrust upon them, and definitely the story of Pope Francis is that, but Jonathan Pryce brings his wonderful wit, wonderful subtlety to it. You know, and just it's fascinating just to sit and watch him and Anthony Hopkins have a conversation. And it's, you know, and I'm sad that movie and these two performances, because it's been such a wonderful year of big performances. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of sad that they're sort of getting, you know, just, you know, not necessarily swept under the rug, but just kind of an asterisk maybe in the whole thing, because I really do think that these two performances are worth seeing.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, yeah, I mean, we just went through, like, you could add seven more actors to this list of five, but it's just such a great year for performances. You know, not like we already talked to, you're going to hear it on the Best Picture, like just how all of these movies nominated this year are so worthy of, you know, like we could see literally all of these movies going down in history. I could see all of these performances going down in history. Like this is a wonderful, wonderful performance. And again, you're right. Like there's such a, you know, there's an adversarial nature to what they're doing, but it's also just so warm and so welcoming at the same time. And it takes actors as good as Pryce and Hopkins to make that happen. Especially with the specter of a religious film as well, like, you know, with dealing with religion and such. I'm very, very happy to see him up there. I'm going to love seeing him out in the crowd on Oscar night and seeing, I'm really curious as to what they're going to choose as his package. If they do the video package, because it's a lot of great stuff they could choose from in that movie. So there you go. We've highlighted the five. So it's prediction time. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that we're probably both picking Joaquin Phoenix. Is that correct, Brandon?
Yeah. I mean, has there ever been more signs pointing to something?
The acting categories are not very competitive this year, guys.
I find it fascinating that for such a year of riches that we've gotten, every single acting category is a lock. It's amazing to me.
Yeah. You figured they'd spread it out a little bit more, at least in the other award shows, but what are you going to do?
Yeah, but I guess they're just determined to give these four people the awards this year. And so, I don't think, well, with the exception of Laura Dern, I can't argue the other three, you know, you can argue the Laura Dern performance maybe, it's going to be Phoenix unless some, you know, strange thing has happened over the last couple of weeks and someone else has gained momentum.
Right. And I'll tell you this, like, if this one goes weird, then the whole night has gone weird. You know, you're going to know very early on in the broadcast if the voters have been as scattered as they might be, because it's not even just that. And I said this on another podcast, like, I remember Mad Max Fury Road year. That was a lot of really weird spread out, like, not or wins that, you know, you really weren't expecting, like, not just for that movie, but those wins were all over the place that year. This right. year could be that. I mean, there's so many great movies, and not even just great movies, but great movies in different disciplines. Like, normally a movie like 1917 would have a lock on stuff like sound design and sound mixing, if not for Ford v Ferrari, that also has would be a lock for stuff like that. So, I mean, it's just there's a lot of different ways that this can go. But I will say, Joaquin, he has, as you said, a checkered history with Hollywood and with the movie community, but he's shown a lot of maturity and a lot of grace with his acceptance speeches this year. Every single one of them, all four, have been just really, really fantastic. He's called out Heath Ledger. He's called out his fellow nominees and seems to really genuinely love that he's included with this many great, talented people. It seems like Joaquin has grown up quite a bit in recent years from the problems that plagued him. Do you agree?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, it seems to me that he's just kind of, he seems to be wanting to make amends for some of the bridges he's burned over the years. Mm-hmm. And he seems to be getting back into the good graces of everybody. So, Hollywood loves a comeback, you know. So to see him again, and, you know, and of course it's, you know, Renee Zellweger didn't burn any bridges, but she hasn't made a movie in 6 years too. But people, people love when someone who's been away for a while comes back and gives a good performance.
Yeah, and so people with immense talent. I mean, Joaquin has all the talent in the world. I honestly think he could be the next coming of, like, Daniel Day-Lewis. I really do. Like, he could be that good in every single performance that he does. He's got that talent. You know, and now that I've compared someone to Daniel Day-Lewis, I will burst into flames. Anyway, all right, that's going to do it for this Spotlight of Best Actor. Again, we have one more left for you. Best Picture will be coming your way tomorrow. Today, you will also see an article from Lou Hare on NPR Illinois, which he ranks all 9 of the Best Picture nominees. Actually, no, that's going to be tomorrow on Sunday. Today, you're also going to be getting Phil Rockwell's Pop Culture Draft Night on the Oscar Draft. You're going to be seeing that one out there and what his crew picked. And of course, we will keep track of those point tallies to tell you who wins. But of course, also, you can join us, people. You can join us at the Hoagland Center for the Arts on Sunday, tomorrow night. You can go and watch the Oscars with us. Take part in our lightning round trivia on each commercial break. And of course, also try to win the big prize with the ballot contest. But of course, if you can't make it there, we will be doing live Facebook Live videos on every single commercial break with some special guests, our good friend Courtney Enlow from the Trends Like These podcast and Ryan Mitchelly from Walk Away Entertainment, a real life movie maker. He's going to be there. So commenting on what happened. So Brandon, anything else that you want to mention before we wrap up here?
No, not really. We've been podcasting rapidly here lately. So it's amazing. I mean, I can't believe I've been able to release a classics episode and done all
this. You did.
You were
on it, man. Everybody's been on it. I am so insanely proud of the entire Front Row Network. So, all right, everyone. Get it. Mark your calendars. Tomorrow night, we're going to be at the Hoagland Center. Join us. Tickets are still available, but they are going very, very fast now because we're getting up on the day. So get them really quick. All right. That's going to do it for this episode of Oscar Spotlight for the Front Row Network. I am Jeremy Gechner.
I'm Brandon Davis.
And as always, we will see you in the front row. This episode is a production of the Front Row Network, a proud Community Voices member of National Public Radio, Illinois. For more information and to see the full slate of Front Row Network shows, you can visit frnpod.com or nprillinois.org.